The next presentation is from Jeffrey Lamb, from the Panhandle to the Holy Land.
Okay, slideshow from the beginning. All right, I'm Jeff Lamp. I don't have my name tag with me right now, but I am registered. I should be here. And I'm a professor of New Testament here at ORU, and I'm an instructor in environmental science. So I kind of straddle both of those worlds here at ORU. And I want to talk a little bit about how we go about perhaps reading the issues related to the Babylonian exile, maybe through a conversation with the what we had in historically here in recent memory with the Dust Bowl. So that's kind of where I'm going with this. I hope it comes out like I want it to. Really what I want to look at, I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the Babylonian exile. I'm going to assume we remember that story from Sunday school. And I don't want to spend a lot of time with that. But what I do want to point out is that the Babylonian exile is actually a series of exiles where deportations happened over a 30 or 40 year period. The one we focus on is the one that happened in 587, which is when the temple itself was destroyed and basically the bulk of the remaining elite, as well as what we might call the hoi polloi, were kind of carried off to Babylon. There was one further exile or deportation about 5 years after this that kind of brought it all to a conclusion. This is not to say every human being resident in that part of the world at that time ended up in Babylon. All right, not every person was. There were still people of the land in those areas, and I want to keep that in mind as we kind of go through here. The causes of the exile are pretty well known biblically. We attribute them to idolatry. But also we attribute it to the refusal to bow to Babylon. Once the judgment's pronounced, the prophets warn, don't resist this. Don't fight. Destruction will come. So that's part of the refusal to obey that prophetic word. The usual suspects, a lot of these gods we see mentioned in Scripture. I resisted the temptation to put a logo from American Idol up here. But I did find a pretty good picture of Billy Idol, the pop star from the 80s, and I resisted that as well. But I want to consider this in terms of thinking about the exile. Out of Leviticus 25, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving you, the land shall observe a Sabbath for the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in their yield. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of complete rest for the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. You shall not reap the aftergrowth of your harvest or gather the grapes of your unpruned vine. It shall be a year of complete rest for the land. You may eat what the land yields during its Sabbath. You, your male and female slaves, your hired and your bound laborers who live with you, your livestock also, and the wild animals in your land, all its yield shall be for food." And this is in Leviticus 25. Now, every seventh year, the land is supposed to lie fallow to experience complete rest. And this is characterized as a Sabbath for the Lord. Now, there is a very clear theological connection here, as it harkens back to the seventh day account in Genesis chapter 2. Old Testament scholar Norman Hobble sees here a focus on viewing the land in terms of an agrarian ideology, where the land is characterized as God's personal garden and sanctuary that is entrusted to the Israelites to tend as tenant farmers in the context of a Sabbath economy. Moreover, every 50th year, the land is to experience an additional year of rest in the year of Jubilee. As with many of the commands given by God to the Israelites, there is a pragmatic element present in the legislation, namely allowing the land to restore itself as it lay fallow. Well, what if they don't do it? And this is where I think we start coming into the issue of idolatry again. If they don't do it, Leviticus 26 tells us, "Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbath years as long as it lies desolate while you are in the land of your enemies. Then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbath years. As long as it lies desolate, it shall have the rest it did not have on your Sabbaths when you were living on it." So Leviticus 26, if we read the whole chapter, a lot of this chapter is about, okay, what will God do if indeed you do follow the rules? But a lot of it is spent talking about what will happen if you don't. And it talks in really horrific terms. What will happen? Failing crops, enemy invasions, attacks by wild animals, death, and finally removal from the land. And I want you to keep Leviticus 26 in mind as we get a little further into the presentation, because it will come back to haunt us. And guess what? This is a passage out of 2 Chronicles that is a post-exilic interpretation, looking back on what happened with the exile. He, Nebuchadnezzar, took into exile in Babylon those who escaped the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had made up for its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. The chronicler here is interpreting the exile, that 70-year exile that Jeremiah spoke about, as a failure to observe Sabbath. So whatever else is going on with idolatry, very closely connected to it, is a failure to give the land its Sabbath. And that's a very significant part of why the people go into exile. Now, why that will be the case, we'll spend a little bit of time talking about it. And what I want to do is ask the question, how does land neglect and abuse work in conjunction with idolatry to produce the Babylonian exile? And to do that, I want to take a look at the Dust Bowl. And I think we all probably remember, you know, what the Dust Bowl was. We've seen the imagery. If we watched the Ken Burns documentary, we see all that stuff. In Oklahoma, it's a big part of our sort of cultural memory here. Downtown, we have a wonderful museum, the Woody Guthrie Center, that in large part brings us back to that time in the nation and state's history. It's a wonderful place to go. It's my second church. So let's take a look at the Dust Bowl. Little geography lesson here. When we talk about the Dust Bowl, we're talking largely about a very small, relatively speaking, location that takes in parts of Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico, and Colorado, even though dust storm damage did extend throughout much of the Great Plains during this time period. And this is the time period we're interested in is the 30s, the decade of the 1930s. What caused the Dust Bowl? Well, to ask that question or to answer it, we need to kind of go back and see what took place. In the 19th century, there was a move west, a push west, a migration west. The Homestead Act in 1862 allotted 160-acre farms to people who would make that trek. They were assisted in that when in 1869 the Transcontinental Railroad was completed. Now you could get people out west pretty quickly. There was also a propaganda that was given by the government in this. The rain will follow the plow. So if you go out to this big, massive meadow, this big, massive grassland, dig it all up and plant stuff that's not supposed to be planted there, the act of you tilling the soil will bring the rain. Talking of Disney magic here a little bit ago, I just love that kind of idea. In 1909, they had the Enlarged Homestead Act, which increased the size of farms to 640 acres, and that'll be important here in just a second. And then you've got the waves of immigrants in the early 20th century. My family on my dad's side are Germans off the boat. They ended up farming in South Dakota. You know, you've got all those European immigrants setting up farms in the Midwest as part of this sort of westward migration. Land use transition. What was largely grazing land now is being converted to use for wheat. All right, if you just sort of look around, you see lots of wheat in this part of the world now. More than a century ago, you wouldn't have seen that. Why? Prairie grasses, things like that grew here naturally. When you remove the native, grasses to increase land for wheat production, because somebody realized, look, it doesn't rain much out here. We need bigger farms if we're going to have good crops. So that's why they expanded the size of the farm in the allotments. You need to increase that. World War I drove up wheat prices. So we need more wheat. We've got to grow more wheat. Turn up more land, you know, get the farms bigger. And as time moved into the 1920s, it looked like this is a really good idea because we hit a wet cycle in the rain. And the winters were mild, so it was really good for wheat production. All right, so life looks good in the 1920s. Agricultural technology. We can have 640-acre farms. Why? Because we have mechanized tractors, combines to harvest. We have the disc plows. You no longer have that one single blade behind an ox and one of your 18 kids guiding it. So that's technology helps. The suitcase farmer. This guy here in the suit on the back of the tractor here. The suitcase farmer is one of those guys who owns the farm but doesn't live anywhere near it. His only interest, profits. If I own this farm, you need to give me wheat. And then that's all he cares about. What caused the Dust Bowl? In the 1930s, the government produced a documentary, The Plow That Broke the Plains. Once you start making a documentary that says that, whose fault is the Dust Bowl? Ours, because I put the plow to the ground. And this was, again, government propaganda to an extent, because now this enabled the programs that proved necessary to kind of help recover from the Dust Bowl. Right, but this was a documentary. We're all familiar with Ken Burns' documentary, and when you start watching his documentary, you see this line, the worst man-made ecological disaster in American history. Okay, so you have that kind of thing going along here. Well, the conclusion basically is if that's what's going on, then what caused the Dust Bowl? In part, greed. Okay, so greed is part of the cause of the Dust Bowl. Which, if you ask the Apostle Paul, what is greed? Paul says that greed is idolatry. So now we're kind of coming back a little bit. That idolatry and land abuse kind of come into play in the Dust Bowl. Now, we wouldn't call it idolatry because we're probably not carving statues and worshiping them. But Paul says idolatry is a deeper problem than that. So what caused the Dust Bowl? You can't get around this fact. Look. It didn't rain. You know, one of the things that's interesting is people have gone back and done sea surface temperature studies, modeling, to try to figure out what caused the Dust Bowl. Can you explain it just in terms of ocean currents, basically? Well, they studied two droughts in the 20th century, the Dust Bowl and then the one that took place in the plains from 46 to 56. And what they discovered was this. Their models predicted that second drought perfectly, but it could not predict the Dust Bowl because there was an extra factor involved there, and that is atmospheric dust loading. So the fact that there was all this extra dust kicked up, kind of in a cycle, it didn't rain. Now you've got all this exposed dirt, no crops to hold it in place. It's now once you get that dust in the atmosphere, that's a factor that increases the severity of the drought in the Dust Bowl. So you can't get around, yeah, the Dust Bowl was probably exacerbated by human greed and all that kind of stuff, but it just didn't rain. You know, when you have that happen, that's kind of a problem. Some of the effects, you look at the soil, 100 million acres of farmland lost topsoil. What does it take? It takes, what, a million years or something like this to create 3 centimeters of topsoil? So when you're losing 100 million acres of that, that's a big deal. In 1934, 300 million tons of dust blew to the East Coast. It was seen in New York and Washington, D.C. That starts to get people's attention about what's happening back west. Black Sunday, April 14th, 1935, 300 million tons of topsoil was removed from the plains. In 1934-35, that winter, there was red snow in New England because of the dust that was kicked up during the Dust Bowl. And you know, we've all seen images like this, these big impending dust clouds that are just unbelievable. We had plagues, grasshoppers come through, rabbits. There were rabbit kills that were like social events taking place because the things that the storms didn't get, the rabbits and the locusts got. So this is starting to look like biblical proportion at this point. But what did we learn in Leviticus 26? Well, if you don't treat the land right, the wild animals come in. So this kind of thing is happening here. Of course, the Okies, which is our exile, people leave the land. They estimated 2.5 million people left the Great Plains total. About 200,000 went to California. It's hard to know exactly how many of the Oklahoma people went out there. It's really hard to nail that down, but it's thousands. Dust pneumonia. No official statistics on this, but dust pneumonia, breathing the dust causes all sorts of respiratory issues. The Red Cross opened up 6 hospitals in 1935 to treat the disease. At one event, they passed out 10,000 gauze masks, and people were wearing these kinds of concocted gas masks and face covers to deal with it. We did learn some things from the Dust Bowl, erosion control techniques, no or low-till farming. We learned so you don't kick up the deep cutting of the ground. Contour farming to help water retention. Wind blocks to keep that from adding to erosion. And then finally, just letting some of the land revert back to native grassland. That's one of the things we learned to let happen. There was another lesson from the Dust Bowl that we don't hear, and this is it. Not everybody left, and not everybody who stayed behind died, and not everybody who stayed behind starved. The fact, droughts and dust storms have been typical of the Great Plains, and we've had record of that for 700 or 800 years in the past. We could examine that kind of thing. Droughts happen about every 25 years. It just happens. It's the way the life works. Fact, not everybody left. Fact, when it rained, there were no dust storms. In the 1920s, there was no Dust Bowl. Why? It rained. If it rains and wheat covers the ground, it's not blowing away. The problem is when it stops raining. And one of the things there's another documentary that came out at about the time Ken Burns' documentary did, but it wasn't funded as nicely, is a thing called Harvesting the High Plains. It's about GK Farms. Ray Garvey and John Criss up in Kansas had a 20,000-acre farm, and it thrived during the Dust Bowl. Why? Because they listened to the land. How do you farm this area? They would let land lie fallow so it would enrich in terms of moisture retention. So they knew how to farm. In other words, they honored the land. They listened to the land. They weren't making it do something it wasn't supposed to do. So you could make it. I want to kind of draw a real quick comparison, a few ideas about the Holy Land and the Great Plains with respect to the exile and the Dust Bowl. Before the Israelites came to Canaan and before the westward migration, the land was productive. People grew stuff. They ate. They lived. They also had knowledge of the conditions necessary to farm because there are droughts in the Middle East. You know, they knew what the weather was. They knew what grew there. In the Dust Bowl, you know, there were people who knew how to grow stuff. Things, you knew what to do, a lot of cattle grazing. It's what the land could support. After the people came in, the Israelites come into Canaan, the westward migration, the land had productivity after people came in. You know, it worked. There were periodic droughts, like I said, and you just had to live with that. In both cases, obviously, God gets the credit or the blame. Why did the people go into exile? God judged them. What was a lot of the rhetoric in churches at the time of the Dust Bowl? Your greed has brought this upon you. But there was not total destruction and exile. There were people still in the Holy Land. In fact, a lot of the poor in the land found out, wait a minute, a lot of people left and left really cool places to live behind for us. This is the land enjoying its Sabbaths, according to the chronicler, where the poor and all those can eat off of what the land produces. So while the land isn't Sabbath, it's still supporting people. And it's attributed to idolatry, as we've seen. But I want to look at this. What I want to say is there's a failed land contract in both cases. And what do we mean by a land contract, real quick? What land contract? Sabbath as the goal of creation. I want to look at a few patterns here. 6 days of seven, God works, then rests. 6 days of seven, humans work, then rest. 6 years of seven, land works, then rest. So what is this all about? What I want to talk in terms about a land contract is this. Go back to the idea of Sabbath. There's a lot of work being done in scholarship now that's looking at the pattern of creation described in Genesis 1 and comparing it to the descriptions of the building of the tabernacle in Exodus. And what they're noticing is there's such close similarities there that what they're thinking is that creation's goal was to become the dwelling place of God. And that's exactly what Sabbath is. When you build a temple in the ancient world, a deity comes to reside in it. And that's what Sabbath is God resting in his temple. So that what we see here in terms of Sabbath, with all of this resting going on, is that God's work is to plant a garden in which to rest. The humans maintain this garden as their priestly service toward God on behalf of creation. Since most labor in the ancient world was agricultural, human work is strongly connected to the land's work. Work and rest of God, humans, and land establish a rhythm in creation in which humans fulfill their mandate as divine image bearers to establish God's benevolent rule in the world. Thus, God is honored and the purpose and destiny of creation is confirmed to be the place where God and humans co-inhabit and all enjoy the blessings of divine presence and communion. So in other words, what this planet was supposed to be is the dwelling place of God, in which he walks, as we see in Genesis, in his creation with the humans in the cool of the evening. That's what that kind of represents there. So this is kind of the land deal. So what does it come down to? Let's go back to idolatry one last time. Leviticus 26. I told you that Leviticus 26 talks about all the bad stuff that happens when you don't honor the Sabbath, when you don't honor what God has intended for the land. The writer starts off chapter 26 with these words. God's telling through Moses, you shall make for yourselves no idols and erect no carved images or pillars, and you shall not place figured stones in your land to worship at them. For I am the Lord your God. You shall keep my Sabbaths, not just the seventh day, but the seventh year. You will keep my Sabbaths and reverence my sanctuary. Not just the tabernacle, but creation is supposed to be the divine sanctuary. I am the Lord. And then he goes into this long discussion about the Sabbath type of legislation. If you follow the Sabbath, this will be the good stuff. If you don't, bad stuff will happen. And we see Paul again. I'll bring this to you. Put to death what is earthly. He lists a bunch of stuff, and then he concludes with greed, which he identifies as idolatry. Idolatry is, in essence, a failure to worship God properly as those who bear the image of God, which is to embody the divine presence in the world and establish God's benevolent rule and presence in all creation. That's what image bearing is. It's to basically take the presence of the deity into a location. So as image bearers, as we go out into the world, have dominion, serve and protect, all that stuff, we're extending God's benevolent care into creation. All right? In Israel's case, worshiping idols in their land is a failure to recognize their role as a Sabbath people, to extend the rule of God into all creation. All right? Israel had this as this is their sort of Abrahamic calling, is to extend this into all creation. Their failure to treat the land as God prescribed is intimately connected to the worship of other gods. It rejects the God who gave them this land for a purpose, and this is the important purpose to keep in mind. The Sabbath stuff is a sign of what God will do to bring creation to its intended destiny. So in other words, the Sabbath isn't just to get a day off. It isn't just to let the land rest. It's to recall the destiny of creation from the Genesis account, which is this place is supposed to be where God dwells. And that's what Sabbath deals with. The failure to do the Sabbath is not just, I did some work and I shouldn't have. It's a matter of not recognizing what God's plan for creation is and Israel's role in helping to reestablish that. So it's a matter of rejecting God. That's why it's idolatry. Okay? They lost sight of this truth. Their connection to the land was more than just survival. It was testimony of God's redemptive plan in the world to restore creation to its destiny. They broke their covenant with God, which caused them to violate the covenant with the land. So God sent them into exile in part to demonstrate his fidelity to the covenant with the land, which always entailed more than just giving his people a place to live. In other words, Sabbath, the land, all that stuff has a bigger significance in the divine drama than just you get to live in this land and you get the seventh day off. All right, so there's more to it than this. In today's world, the human vocation to be stewards of the land is not revoked either through the fall or with the coming of Christ. That Genesis mandate that's been perverted, I would argue, through time, the dominate and subdue, has been perverted into dominate and exploit. I think you could argue pretty significantly. But I think a Revelation 11:18 is very important in this respect. In one of these oracles of wrath, John tells us, "Your wrath has come for destroying those who destroy the earth." What this tells me is that the divine mandate and vocation from the beginning of creation has not been taken from us. Our job is to be the image-bearing divine presence in the world, seeking to extend God's benevolent care to all creation, thus preparing it to be the divine dwelling place. And we see at the end of Revelation, that's where this thing's going. God's going to come live here again. The Dust Bowl shows what happens when greed overrides careful consideration of stewardship of the land. Land as an exploitable resource overrides consideration of the human connection to the land and its ultimate purpose. Right? So even though we might not be erecting stones and statues and things, the bottom line is that we are still idolatrous. And it is still affecting our role as human image bearers to care for creation and extend God's benevolent care for it throughout creation. So we're still idolaters in that respect. We as humans in this day and age, and I would bet that if you took a poll, most of the people in the Dust Bowl regions would have said they were Jesus believers. They were probably filling churches every Sunday. They were not fulfilling their human vocation with respect to creation. And this is an element of demonstrating idolatry, manifested in land abuse, not recognizing what the connection between God, land, and humans really means in the overall redemptive drama. One last little slide here. Can the Dust Bowl happen again? Or why hasn't it happened since? I showed you this graphic earlier. The reason we don't really see a lot of Dust Bowls now is that in about that same time period, we discovered something fun, the Ogallala Aquifer. And notice how it's basically under the same geography. So we don't need the rain that much anymore because we can pump the water out of the ground. The problem is that's a glacial aquifer. You're not going to get that recharged with rainfall, given the rate that we're taking it out of there. I've heard estimates, maybe we've got 50 years left. Maybe. Once that goes, then you need rain, and then we see what happens to the wheat fields. So it could happen again. Interstellar was a fun movie. Everybody had fun talking about all that stuff. But the interesting part of Interstellar was it's all predicated on a new Dust Bowl. So all the cool space-time stuff that everybody talks about is basically we're having to entertain that because we're sent into exile. So I think that it serves as a little bit of a, obviously some of the stuff there might not be literally true, but I think it does bear witness. What do we do when the aquifer runs out? And what if global climate change is happening? You know, we might have another, Dust Bowls are happening in other parts of the world. So anyway, I'll stop with that.
Thank you so much, everyone. We have time for one question.
I have made my case.
No one dare come against you.
So, I'll make one comment.
Okay.
Please, can you respond? You can hear me. I don't know if you've read Sir Walter Anderson and Tiny Prince.
No, I haven't.
No, it's a neat book, especially Appendix 2. He was a late preacher in the 1800s that was so detailed that he was called Scotland Yard that helped find clues for Jack the Ripper, and eventually became director of Scotland Yard. But he was known for going to the Bible with the chronology of Greek calendars, the Olympics, Roman calendars, and matching the Bible to help the Bible have a timeline. And what he found on the 7 years prophecy, he dovetailed over to the 70 years in Babylon, that for 490 years previous that, and he can show it to the day, which is really neat that God works to the day on time, that the land Sabbaths were not kept. And at that time, they went into Babylon and the land Sabbaths were kept by the power of God. So it sort of gives us the message, and they came out exactly to the day on 70 years. Well, they came out in a couple of Exoduses, but the temple wasn't rebuilt until exactly the day dedicated 70 years after. It just tells me that God controls things beyond human agency, that lets me know that he's God. And how important the Sabbath is.
Yeah, I think the thing with the Sabbath is, you know, one of the great, I think, problems in Protestant theology, for example, is that we've kind of said the Ten Commandments are all cool except number 4, keeping the Sabbath. And, you know, and we read Paul saying, don't worry about days and seasons and all that kind of stuff. So I think what happens is we've kind of focused on not following the calendrical side of that, but we've not really gotten down to what is the Sabbath supposed to really do. And I think that when we see the Sabbath in this kind of larger sort of creative drama and redemptive drama, I think we end up getting to a place where we can see that Sabbath is more than just getting a day off of work and, you know, not having restaurants and liquor stores open on Sunday.
A good word in Hebrew for Shabbat. I like a better translation than rested, because we know that God didn't go to sleep and start.
Right, yeah. That's why I think that the idea that, hey, wait a minute, look, the pattern of creation and the pattern of the tabernacle. Well, what is the tabernacle's responsibility? It's a place for God to come dwell. Yeah, creation, it's a place for God to come dwell.
And the seventh day, the Sabbath, is not finished in that all the other 6 days have evening and morning, but this one does not.
Right, and in Hebrews it says that Jesus is basically the Sabbath. So he takes that up into himself. So
while Ken's still setting up, just a thought. Sometimes we could blame the people in the Dust Bowl for sinning and creating that problem. But a lot of it is the consumption on the other side. Let's say we need this agricultural food right now. It is happening now. We can blame China, for example, for all the air pollution, but it's driven by our consumption here in, say, developed countries like the U.S. So stop blaming others and realize, you know, we're all in this together. Maybe our side is driving it more than their side.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you look kind of like what's the big sort of migration now, westward migration back then kind of exacerbated it. What is it now? You might argue that it's corporate agriculture. You know, because it's not just eating up land, it's ruining the land in the process. So, yeah, there's all kinds of, I think, issues that come into play at that level.